This is the Medicast, March 12th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 57. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I want to thank all of you for picking up this podcast. For all of you brand new listeners out there, this is the show. This is the Medicast podcast for EMTs, medical professionals, paramedics, hospital personnel, everybody of all kinds that's interested in emergency medicine. Well, I want to welcome you to the program. Check out some back episodes. Check out the website over at MedicCast.com and get a sense of the community that is the MedicCast. And of course, for all of you long-term listeners that contribute comments, questions, material for the show, and of course, corrections when I make a mistake, I appreciate all of that stuff, and that's what makes this show a strong program and a resource for all of us. So thank you all very much. It has been an exciting weekend. I got a chance to get down to the EMS Today show and go around and check out the expo hall down in Baltimore this weekend, and I had a great time. I saw a bunch of great products, and I'm looking forward to going over and talking about some of those with those of you that were in attendance and a few of you that may not have been but know about it. You can check out the Medicast Live this Tuesday night where we'll have a live call-in show, and I'll have more details about that later. Another thing that really got me hopped up over the weekend was the fact that I got a chance to meet with other EMS bloggers and podcasters. We set up an informal meeting. Thanks to Eric at EMS Haiku and Dan White over at the Paramedic blog, they set up a meetup for anybody that was a blogger or a podcaster at a nearby sports club, sports bar. And we sat down and really had, I think, something that's going to set the stage for the coming year in EMS podcasting. And I'm really, really excited about that. I had a chance to talk directly with Peter Canning over at the Street Watch Notes of a Paramedic blog. I also met up with Rick Rosati at the Mitigation Journal podcast and John Bignall down from Canada from the EMS Live podcast, as well as, I said, Dan White and Eric over at EMS Haiku. I have a link to all their stuff over at the website, so you can find the link from the post I put up Saturday morning, I think. And we talked a lot about where we thought the podcasting and blogging world was going, and how that is really a solid resource for all of us in EMS to get some information that we can share. Not necessarily textbook information, although a lot of that is there, but getting a sense of that other people go through the same things we do, getting a sense that the same kind of call that you went on that drove you nuts last night is a call that somebody else has already done, and helps us share the knowledge that we're all really brothers and sisters in this job we do. And so I'm looking forward to the coming year, a lot of exciting things happening. Part of that's going to be, I think, part of it's going to be brought together on the Medicast Live. Part of it's going to be brought together with John Bignall at EMS Live and other podcasts like Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal podcast and Your Studio A podcast. All of those EMS podcasts that are out there that help make this community. So look forward to a lot of innovations in that area over the coming year. We didn't talk about anything specific, but we got a sense that when we were together in that location, that we had a lot of information, a lot of background, and a lot of knowledge to share with each other, and consequently with you, our listening audience, and our reading audience, for those of you that check out the blogs. So look forward to that. I'm really excited, and we'll check out more about that later in this podcast. But first, I want to get into some listener emails that I got. And first and foremost, I want to really thank listener Victoria, who shot me an email bright and early on Monday morning and said, "Hey, there's a problem with the download at the iTunes store of the recent episode of the Medicast." I went over and checked it out, and sure enough, there was a problem with the file. The file I had uploaded, that's the enhanced podcast file for iTunes, was corrupted in some way. I'm not entirely sure what the problem was. Something must have happened during the upload process. And Victoria let me know. I really appreciate it. Victoria is a nursing student interested in emergency and trauma work, and she's going to be taking the EMTB course this summer. So, Victoria, thank you very much. Good luck in your studies. And I want to thank you for letting me know that there was a problem, and I was able to get that repaired probably in about an hour after I had troubleshot. I don't know what you say for that. But anyway, I'd figured out what was wrong and got it reloaded and fixed the problem. And thank you very much for letting me know about that. I'm sure she was not the only one who ran into that problem. And a bunch of you probably went back and checked and re-downloaded it, and it came down just fine the second time. So thanks to Victoria for that. I also got an email from Andy, who has sent me an email before. Both he and his wife, Pam, have sent me some contacts, and they were talking about, relating back to me about the in-flight emergencies, and they had just talked about that they were on a flight and had a medical emergency, and during the flight, they got a call for a medical professional on the plane. One of the things they noted was that the flight attendant asked for identification. They wanted to know and see a license from somebody that said that you are a designated medical professional of some kind. So this is an urgent requirement for you guys. If you're going to be traveling and you want to be available to help out, one of the things you're going to need to show is some sort of identification, whether it's your state EMT card, your national registry card, whatever it is you have, you want to keep that on you at all times. So, Andy, thanks for sending that in to me and bringing this to my attention. I appreciate that. I also got an email from listener Manny, who sent me some information on a new simulator that was purchased here in Maryland by the Anne Arundel Community College, and it is an ambulance simulator. And Manny, thank you very much. I put a link to the story up in the show notes. It's over at emsresponder.com, and I've talked about these ambulance simulators before. They're really cool. What they do is they create the box of an ambulance, and then there's cameras inside that look at the patient from different angles, and it helps new EMTs and new paramedics train to do their procedures in the confined space of an ambulance, that they need to get used to doing things without all the open space you might find in a classroom. So it's a great story to read and learn a little bit about, and I thank Manny for sending that link in. Finally, I want to send a thank you out to Chris Black and listener Randy Gerard, who both were instrumental in helping me get the first inaugural edition of the Medicast Live up and running. They participated and helped out with the show, and I wanted to thank them very much. Randy shared with me a personal instance where he dealt with a flight attendant and asked them specifically about what kind of medical supplies they carried. He identified himself as a paramedic, and the person was all too willing to share that information. Apparently, she had been on a flight where there was a cardiac arrest a few flights before, and they did not have anybody else on board, and all they could do was hook the AED up and do CPR until they could get to the ground. And unfortunately, as we probably expect in such a situation, the patient died. But Randy was actually able to take a look at some of the stuff they had in the back and found out that they have a full ALS an ACLS drug kit up in the cockpit that can be reached if there's a person qualified to use that medications. In the back, they have ET tubes, IV supplies, and some limited medications and first aid supplies. But in the cockpit, they do have a full ACLS kit, at least on this particular flight. So, Randy, thanks for sharing that with me. And again, Randy and Chris, thanks for helping out with the Medicast Live. Well, let's jump right on into the news. There were two really bad accidents that I came upon this week in the news dealing with ambulances. The first happened in Seattle, Washington area, and it involved an SUV that blew a stop sign and ran right in front of an ambulance that was transporting a patient to the hospital. The ambulance T-boned, the passenger side of the SUV, severely injuring the front seat passenger and, of course, causing injuries to the driver of the SUV as well. They were transporting a patient at the time, and the patient and the EMT in the back both sustained some injuries, but none of them severe, thank goodness. But it just reminds us all to be much more careful. And even though we may have the right of way, to really pay attention in situations where people are driving along the road. You can't be sure they're going to stop at the stop sign, folks. That's just the way it is. And we have to be defensive drivers. There's just no other way around it. There is some evidence, at least according to Washington State Police, that alcohol may have been involved with the driver of the SUV, but I don't know that for sure other than the statements in this article. The second incident involved, unfortunately, the death of both the patient and a provider in the back of the ambulance when an ambulance in Upper Michigan rear-ended a logging truck that was parked on the side of the road at a high rate of speed. Now, not sure exactly why the ambulance struck the logging truck. There's no idea or speculation about that now, but the provider in the back and the patient were both killed, and the two people in the front seat of the ambulance are being treated for their injuries. So again, folks, we just need to exercise extra care and be extra careful. And our hearts and thoughts and prayers go out to the families of those that died in this horrible accident. Okay, let's get into some happier news. Providers in the state of Arizona have come up with a great idea to provide better information to the people in their districts and to help them learn about emergency services and first aid operations. And they have done that by going to the shopping mall and having a kiosk or a booth there that they can provide an opportunity to share information with people. So they have everything there from patrol cars to a rollover simulator, a bomb squad robot was there. All of these things were showcased at the Santa Maria Town Center as part of a Public Safety Awareness Day. Now, this is a fantastic idea. You know, if you've listened to the show in the past, I really get excited about what I call out-of-the-box solutions to getting information to our patients. And I'm really a strong believer in prevention as the number one way to save our patients from serious injury or illness. And one of the ways we can do that is finding more new and innovative ways to get out into the community. This is a great opportunity and a win-win situation for the shopping mall. It's a win-win situation for all of the agencies that were present. It's an opportunity for us to increase our visibility in the community and to help educate people. Think about it. One more person that gets to know the signs and symptoms of stroke. One more person that gets to understand that chest pains in people is not just indigestion and that it needs to call 911 and get looked at immediately is one more person that we've saved. One more call that we have that isn't going to be that call that you just wish you weren't on because it's a train wreck from start to finish. We all like the adrenaline. I get that. I really do. But none of us like to see situations deteriorate so fast that we can't stay ahead of them. And that's what happens many times when people have bad information and don't know when to call 911 appropriately. So kudos to the providers and agencies in and around the Santa Maria, Arizona area. They really found a great way to reach out and touch their communities. Okay, so how many times have you been at the hospital and you've stepped into a corner and snuck using your cell phone because you thought that using your cell phone in the hospital is forbidden for reasons of affecting the hospital equipment or causing some kind of mojo that somebody's pacemaker is going to go off? Well, the Mayo Clinic conducted a survey and a study where they actually took cell phones from two different carriers using two different cell phone transmission systems, and they put them through a series of tests with 192 different medical devices. And they found that there was no interference, that hospital equipment was completely unaffected by cell phone use. I use a lot of information from the Mayo Clinic. I think they have a great commitment to providing information and education to the community. If you check back in the month of February, you'll see a lot of articles that I picked up from Mayo Clinic that had to do with Heart Health Month and having a healthy heart and the whole cardiac health situation. And here's just another instance where they have really stepped out and found a practical application for medical study. You know, we see so many studies that deal with things that are very important in their own way, but here is something that is a very practical application, because how often do families in the hospitals have to leave the whole hospital and go out in the parking lot to make a phone call? They're told they can't use their cell phones inside the building because of problems with the transmission interfering with medical equipment. Well, I just want to say kudos to the Mayo Clinic for having an innovative study that has real-time practical applications now. I think that's great. And you can refer to this study. I have a link to it in the show notes, so you can check it out and hand it on to your health hospital administrators in your area. Finally tonight, I picked up on a study that was carried out in Canada having to do with strokes and fatalities being higher from stroke on weekends. Now, this is something that when you look at it, you kind of go, well, yeah, okay, that makes sense. What the study found was that they tracked a series of stroke deaths in 606 Canadian hospitals from April 2003 through March of 2004. They took risk factors like age, sex, illness, and other medical complications into account and found that stroke patients that were hospitalized on weekends were 13% more likely to die than those admitted on weekdays. I suspect this is true for being admitted on late night hours as well, although it doesn't specifically say so. And while the study doesn't exactly point to why, I think it has a lot to do with hospital staffing on the weekends and perhaps even EMS staffing on the weekends. Basically, people who have strokes are going to the hospital, and weekend staff has to call in a CT technician or call in a neurologist because they're not in the building on the weekends. These are a lot of times offices that are staffed 9 to 5 during the work week, and the CT goes home and only comes in when called on the weekends. And this makes perfect sense. So I'm glad someone did a study on this, because I think it's an important thing to look at. Just like a few years ago, there was a big push to take patients to appropriate facilities for cardiac problems, we are just now really getting a big push to take patients to proper stroke care centers. And why that's just so important is pointed out in this study, that patients that are taken to hospitals without round-the-clock care, and let's face it, for most of us, that's probably the bulk of the types of hospitals we go to. Unless you're in a major metropolitan area with a large facility, you're not likely to have a neurologist in the building all night. You're not likely to have a CT scan that's, or even an X-ray machine that's staffed all night long. You have a small rural hospital, they're going to call those people in from home because they don't want to pay out the money to have them on call or on staff all weekend just sitting in the hospital. And, you know, we have to take money into account, unfortunately. I understand that. But we need to find a way to get around this and deal with this particular problem to get stroke patients the care they need. This brings me into this week's tip and trick of the week, which has to do with finding primary stroke centers in your area and what exactly a primary stroke center means. Okay? And this came up recently in a county EMS meeting that I was attending, where a local hospital sent their ER representative, their clinical supervisor, to let us know that they were applying for JACO certification as a primary stroke center and also applying to Maryland for primary stroke center status. And I kind of asked some questions and found out what that means. But then I saw this article about weekends. And this is one of those things where primary stroke centers are really going to be very important facilities in your communities, just like cardiac catheterization centers are important for MI patients, because stroke is really the number one most costly illness in the country right now, in the United States, and I suspect in much of the industrialized world. And the reason is because when a person has a stroke, most often we do save them, but we save them with some major deficits. We save them in a situation where they're paralyzed, in a situation where they are unable to care for themselves anymore, and we end up with a patient that requires thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in extra care every year just to support them and keep them going. And if we had had a better setup in the beginning to get them to definitive care more quickly, both at the patient's side and in the hospital, this provides an opportunity for these patients to have a better outcome, to survive their initial stroke, and to go on to live many more years productively without the additional medical costs and without the additional anguish of the patient and their family. So I looked up some things about primary stroke centers, and over at about.com, I found a whole setup talking about stroke. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about exactly what the Joint Commission for Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, or JACO, has to say about what they require for somebody to be part of a primary stroke center. To start off with, there are two different types of primary stroke centers. There are centers that either choose to keep the patient, stabilize them, and then provide surgical services, neurosurgery, to treat the patient's stroke. And there are other primary stroke centers who are going to be in a situation where they are going to provide stabilizing medication and treatments and identification and diagnosis, and then they are going to rapidly transfer that patient to a center that has round-the-clock neurosurgery, round-the-clock surgical intervention procedures. And this is probably a good fit for hospitals in small rural zones where we have aeromedical transport, and we have the ability to give the patient medications, clot busters, TPA, thrombolytics, things like that, to get the thrombolytics type strokes under control to start decreasing their effects while we get the patient prepped and ready to go for transport to the local surgical center if they need follow-up intervention. So those are the two most important things to remember is they're going to be two different types of primary stroke centers, but they're both going to be important for us to be aware of. So these primary stroke centers are going to have a few things that they're going to require. And this has been developed by an organization called the Brain Attack Coalition. And I love that. It's called the Brain Attack Coalition. It's a multidisciplinary group with members from major organizations involved in stroke care. And I suspect that includes EMS representatives because there is an EMS component here. Acute stroke teams need to be at the primary stroke center. And this is a stroke team that is available 24 hours a day to evaluate suspected stroke patients within 15 minutes of identification of the possibility of a stroke. They must be hospital-based. They must be available around the clock 7 days a week. They must include a physician who has experience with diagnosing and treating strokes and cerebrovascular diseases. They must have a written care protocol situation, so they have established procedures for diagnosis and treatment. And they must have an effective communication and coordination method with local EMS services. This is really great for us because if you have a primary stroke center in your community, they must have facility to deal with us, to communicate with us effectively, and resources to help train us on what they can and can't do. What I said earlier about identification of a suspected stroke patient. Well, I talked to my local representative that was talking to our EMS council at our county level about what this means for their hospital. And what she told me was that means identification in the field as well. So if you've used the Cincinnati Stroke Scale or another stroke diagnostic test, if you have all the signs and symptoms of a stroke and you call into that hospital, they count that 15 minutes from the minute I call. This is important because instead of waiting until this patient gets to the hospital to get triaged, if we have them knowing ahead of time, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes ahead of time, hey, I've got a stroke patient coming in, They can be waiting at the door. They can have their acute stroke team waiting at the door to take this patient and start the diagnostic process immediately upon their walking through the door. And this is important because just like time is heart muscle, time is brain cells. So you can imagine how much of an effect this can have. And one of the things she told me was that even though they're waiting for their accreditation, they have all the pieces in place already. And this is exciting because, while I guess I shouldn't say I can't wait for my next stroke patient, but I can't wait for the opportunity to call this hospital and see this process in action and see if it's really working the way that she says it is. Because we have about a 10 to 15 minute minimum transport time to any of our local facilities. So if I identify a stroke patient, I can call in before we even start a wheel rolling and let them know, hey, I've got a stroke patient coming in. These are the signs and symptoms. I'll call you back in a few minutes with further details. This should be able to set their process in motion, and we should be able to see a whole lot more when we get to the ER, that they'll have some services motivated and ready to go for us. So check that out. All further things that are going to be required of a primary stroke center, the emergency department staff must have additional training and experience in diagnosing and treating stroke patients, and they must demonstrate effective communication with EMS and the acute stroke team inside the hospital. So if you haven't called in and activated it, they have to be able to talk to you and have enough knowledge to activate the stroke team themselves. They must have neurosurgical services. If they're going to be providing surgery, they must have them on staff 24/7. They need to have a support medical organization to ensure delivery of quality and effective care in the hospital and after the patient's been in the hospital. They need to have a rapid diagnostic service, such as a CT scan or an MRI. They must be able to do this, and they must be able to be capable of performing the scan within 25 minutes of a physician's order, and a physician must be available to make that order. So these are all things that have to be in place. They must have laboratory services. They must have things available to do routine blood testing 24/7, EKGs, and chest x-rays. All of these things improve the outcome of the stroke patient. Another anecdotal story from when I talked to the representative locally here, she said that the first time they got to use this, they had a patient come in with full hemiparesis, left-sided weakness and paralysis, unable to speak clearly, unable to formulate words or sentences at all, so completely aphasic. And this patient showed up at the hospital, driven by a relative. They came in the doors, they had the stroke team in place, they got her diagnosed and brought a helicopter in to transport her down to the major center that was going to do the follow-up intervention. They got TPA on board in this patient, and by the time she was on the helicopter, she had completely resolved all of her symptoms. She was able to speak again, she had no more weakness, she had full strength and grips on both sides, and she was basically being flown out to make sure that there was no further complications from this stroke. And that's exciting, you know? We'd all like to see a quicker turnaround on these kind of things and know that we brought a patient in and made that kind of a difference. So I'm excited about this service being available in my community. And I'm hoping that when you find out more about this, you can start asking questions of your local hospitals. Say, hey, are you a local primary stroke center? Or is the neighboring hospital a primary stroke center? This may be a situation where you educate yourself about getting your patient to the best definitive treatment when it's needed at the right time. And that might be bypassing the closest facility to go to a facility that is going to be better able to treat them. Remember, if your CT scan is offline and isn't going to be available until about an hour after you get the patient to the hospital, the extra half hour transport time to the hospital that has full-time CT scan makes a huge difference. Enough said about this. You can check out the link in the show notes and check out the resources in your community. Well, the tip of the week's done. It must be time for this week's Med of the Week. And this week I'm going to cover a whole category of medications and kind of step back out of the pre-hospital realm and into the realm of some of the meds we're likely to see on lists of our patients prescribed or over-the-counter medications. and one we're likely to see, especially in patients that maybe have some pain issues, is a drug in the category of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or the NSAIDs. NSAIDs cover a huge gamut of analgesic medications and anti-inflammatory medications. Medications all the way from aspirin through medications like ibuprofen, Toradol, Naproxen, Celebrex. All of these are NSAID drugs. Some of them are prescription strength. Some of them are over-the-counter. Some of them we already give in the pre-hospital realm, like perhaps aspirin or Toradol, for those of you that have IV Toradol on your units as an alternative to narcotics. All of these things are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. They work in this way. The body produces a family of chemicals called prostaglandins, and they are produced and have several important functions. What they do is they promote inflammation, pain, and fever in order to help the body better fight infection and damage to the body, such as trauma. They also support the function of platelets to help with clotting, and they also protect the lining of the stomach from stomach acids. Prostaglandins are produced in the body's cells by an enzyme called cyclooxygenase. Cyclooxygenase is also shortened to be COX, and there are two different COX enzymes, COX-1 and COX-2. Both of them cause the inflammation, the pain, and the fever, but only COX-1 produces prostaglandins that support platelet and protect the stomach from acids. So when NSAIDs come out, they block the COX enzyme and reduce its ability to produce prostaglandins, thereby reducing the production throughout the body, causing less inflammation and thus less pain, less fever, and enable the body to be in less distress. But unfortunately, they also slow down the clotting of the blood and reduce the stomach's ability to protect itself in the stomach lining from the acid that the stomach produces. So therefore, this is why you have stomach upset sometimes when you take some NSAIDs like ibuprofen or naproxen, or NSAIDs like aspirin is known to increase clotting or reduce clotting times. That's why we give it in cases of MI. Aspirin is unique in that it actually lasts for 4 to 7 days. Most of these only last a couple of hours, but in the case of stomach acid, once you get an ulcer started, it's very difficult to get that ulcer under control again because the acid is constantly irritating it. NSAIDs are used for general treatment of things like headaches, muscle aches and pains. They're a great treatment for people that have arthritis symptoms because arthritis is a disease that is affected by an inflammatory effect. And so by administering something that controls that inflammation reaction of the body, NSAIDs can go out there and deal with that problem a little bit more effectively than something like Tylenol might. There are different levels and strengths of NSAIDs out there. You have old style NSAIDs like aspirin and maybe ibuprofen. You have other NSAIDs that are more selective in their effects, and because they are selective, they have less of an effect on promoting bleeding and causing more stomach upset. And these are known as selective COX-2 inhibitors. They don't affect the COX-1 enzyme. They only affect the COX-2 enzyme. And this would be medications like Celebrex that are more selective, similar to the things we see when we deal with asthma attacks and other things where we're using beta-2 selective medications like albuterol to increase the effect on the body. The same thing happens with COX-2 inhibitors. Other drugs that you might find out there are things like Toradol, which is an IV-administered NSAID and is used as an alternative because it's so much more effective and strong and can be used to treat more severe pain. And so it is used as an alternative to narcotics because it doesn't have the addictive effect and can be administered IV. Some of our units, some of you listeners out there, may be using Toradol already. The side effects of using these medications are similar to some of the side effects that are found in other medications, including nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, you know, the things that we seem to see in the list for every medication. But we also may see things like causing problems with kidney failure, liver failure, ulcers, and prolonged bleeding, especially after injury or surgery. Some people are allergic to NSAIDs and may develop a shortness of breath. It's important to understand that these medications do have an effect on the body, and when taken in larger than prescribed strengths or larger than indicated on the side of the bottle strengths, they may cause problems. You're going to see increased bleeding times. You're going to see patients using this that may have developed other problems as a result of taking too many of them. NSAIDs also, because they affect and reduce blood flow to the kidneys, they affect the action of diuretics. So if you're giving Lasix to a patient, it's going to decrease the effectiveness of that medication. It's also going to decrease the elimination of medications like lithium or other medications like methotrexate. Enzymes decrease the ability of the blood to clot. They will also cause more bleeding complications, and they may also increase blood pressure in patients that already have hypertension and antagonize the action of drugs used to treat it. So make sure that you know this. If you got a patient on ACE inhibitors or beta blockers, that the NSAIDs may counteract some of that. So the patient may be experiencing hypertension even though they're already taking their hypertension medication. Again, a list of these medications that you may see in the field include aspirin, ibuprofen, ketoprofen, naproxen, which is also known as Aleve or Naprosyn. You may see medications like Toradol or Ketorolac and Celebrex, as well as Daypro. All of these are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that you're likely to run into either in patients in the field or patients that you may be transporting from another medical facility. So check it out. And I have links to all of this in the show notes. And I think that's going to wrap up this week's show here at the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for supporting the show and all the ways that you do. Remember, you can head on over to iTunes and the music store for the MedicCast page. You can rate the show over there. You can leave a rating and let people know how much you like the show, both there and at EMS Village. It's a new month, so you can vote over at the Podcast Alley and let people know that you like the show over there. If you want to get information about the show, if you want to get the show notes emailed directly to you, and you want to get an extra tip of the week that only newsletter subscribers get, then sign up for the MedicCast newsletter. You can head on over to the website in the upper right-hand corner. You'll see a link to sign up for the newsletter for free. Sign up for free. I don't send out spam to anybody. You'll get a link back to verify you are who you say you are, and you can go ahead and get signed up for the MedicCast newsletter today. Remember, you can check back midweek for the MedicCast News at the Podcaster News Network. The MedicCast News is where I cover stories that fall through the cracks, stories that I didn't cover over the weekend that are important for you to hear. And it's a 5-minute or 6-minute podcast just with news stories that you might want to listen to midweek over at the MedicCast News at MedicCastNews.com. You can contact me at the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. And you can also contact me in email at podmedic@mac.com. I want to thank all of you for participating with the show, for listening, and for sending me email comments and questions. I'm looking forward to having as many of you as possible over at the MedicCast Live this coming Tuesday night at 10 p.m. I'll be talking about products that are new out there. I'll have some surprise guests, maybe even surprises to me. So head on over to the TalkShoe.com site and sign up now so you can get on over Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Time for the MedicCast Live over there tonight. I will wrap up, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. This one comes from IOTA PromoNet. It's an organization for independent labels, and this is a song from a band called The Big Tees. Support these bands, folks. These guys provide music for podcasters without having to go through all of the rigmarole that the RIAA and the other music bigwigs require. These guys know that we have a way to get their music out there and share with the public. So check out the links in the show notes for this band. It's a great tune from a band called The Big Tees. This is a song called Casanova. I'm going to wrap up here, as I always do, by saying this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
Broadway, the marquee paints a picture of heartbreak in the air. The aristocracy with their expensive seats violin. I check my coat, what a show. It's not my first appearance, residing in the balcony. Music comes alive, but all curtains rise to unveil my deity. Lights are flashing all around her, she's so cosmopolitan. That's too familiar at the end. So can you savor the flavor of your misbehavior and we'll toast to you. So be my Valentine and I'll be your Casanova.